88.3 Southern FM.
And now on the space show, we're off to the Arnhem Space Center. Earlier this year, Miles Hatfield, a science writer at the Goddard Space Flight Center in Greenbelt, Maryland, accompanied a team of scientists to the Arnhem Space Center and watched as they launched a rocket. The rocket was designed to study Proxima Centauri. But why don't I let Miles tell the story himself? Now, this episode is called, it's the first of six episodes, A Star Fit for Life.
Over the last two decades, scientists have found thousands of planets elsewhere in the universe.
These are called exoplanets. As we get better and better at finding them, we need ways to narrow down the ones most likely to support life. Two NASA rocket teams are working to do just that from Australia. Their mission? Study a special pair of stars best seen in the Southern Hemisphere and propel humanity's search for habitable worlds into the future. I'm Miles Hatfield, and I'm following these rocket teams to Australia to show you what it takes to launch a rocket and make groundbreaking scientific measurements. Hang on tight. We're going on an adventure, high above, down under.
Earth is packed with life.
But some environments are more habitable than others. So what makes an environment, or a planet, a good place for life to thrive? Well, one thing is...
water! And in fact, that's what the search for life elsewhere in the universe has focused on so far. Finding planets where water can exist in liquid form.
There's a region around every star that scientists call the Goldilocks zone. A planet in this zone has the right temperature for water to remain liquid. Too close, and the water will evaporate away. Too far, and it'll freeze. The distance has to be just right. This zone has been the basis for the search for habitable worlds. But just because a planet is inside the Goldilocks zone doesn't mean it can sustain life. Take, for example, the closest known exoplanet to Earth at just 4.2 light years away. It's located in the Goldilocks zone, but scientists think the star's frequent eruptions might have blown away any atmosphere the planet might have had. In other words, the Goldilocks zone is just a first guess. To truly tell whether an exoplanet is habitable, we need to look at the star it's orbiting.
Unfortunately, we can't just observe a planet and understand it at face value. We have to understand it in the context of what its parent star is giving it.
So scientists have been collecting data from different types of stars to learn how they affect their planets.
We would like to be able to create a menu of star-planet possibilities that our future missions can draw from and prioritize the most promising places to find habitable environments.
The next item to be added to the menu? Yellow stars. We're looking for something around 5 billion years old, an average size. Wait a second, don't we have one right here? So why not use the sun?
We've thought that our sun is the prototype for kind of 5 billion year old average yellow stars. What we've learned recently is that our sun is actually quite inactive for a 5 billion year old yellow star.
Typical Earthling behavior, really, thinking we're the example for the entire universe. But it turns out, yellow stars are found throughout our galaxy, and they tend to erupt with life-altering activity more often than our sun does. So, if we want to understand if they can still support life, we'll need more data than our sun can give us. That's why two rocket teams are looking to Alpha Centauri A and B.
The reason why we're targeting Alpha Centauri is that it's our nearest solar twin. So in many, many ways, it's just like the sun. It has almost the same mass, it's a very similar age, and it's nearby, which is always great.
And with the help of NASA sounding rockets, they'll capture light from those stars that doesn't make it to the ground.
This range of highly energetic ultraviolet light has never been measured before for these stars. Even small differences in this UV light from a star can determine whether a nearby planet can support life or not. But the Alpha Centauri system isn't visible from most places in the U.S. It's best studied from the Southern Hemisphere.
That's why we're here in Northern Australia, in the traditional homelands of the Yolngu people. They've been observing the stars here for tens of thousands of years.
I'm here with two rocket science teams, Sistine and Deuce, and a crew of about 50 NASA engineers, rocket specialists, and support staff. In partnership with Equatorial Launch Australia and the Gumatch Corporation, they've created an entire rocket range from scratch to help the scientists achieve their goals. In this series, you're going to meet these teams and follow their quest high above the Australian outback to see what it takes to make these first-ever measurements from our closest stellar neighbors. We're going behind the scenes to learn more about the science of habitability and what goes into launching a rocket, dodging venomous snakes and crocodiles along the way. But first, we'll take a look at how this brand new rocket range came to life with the help of the Yolnu people, who have been observing these stars for millennia.
You heard there about the exoplanet Proxima b and how this is to study it. Well, we've got a poem here about Proxima b.
Prox b by Stuart Atkinson, posted on 2016 August 30th. Proxima Centauri, Sol's closest star. Too faint by far for the naked eye to see under even the clearest, moon-free Chilean sky, and in a telescope's eyepiece never more than a mere red speck, a spark spat out of a fire. I can't even see you from this far north. Earth gets in the way. I'd need to pull up my horizon like a rug to scan the sky for you, searching for a ruddy pollen grain halfway between Mars and the stars of the Southern Cross. But I know you're there. For centuries we thought you barren, a lonely, shrunken sun, a tiny sequin sewn in the black velvet cloak of the southern sky. But now we know the treasure you were hiding all along. Circling you, like a moth whirling round a flame, is a world destined for fame since its birth. Though exoplanet hunters proclaim you Earth-like, you are not Terra's twin. At least, nothing like the Earth as people think of it. A perfect Christmas tree bauble, glazed blue and white, shining in the endless black night of space, with snow-capped mountains, oceans rolling up golden sandy beaches with a hiss, kissing the sapphire sky at the horizon. No, your discoverers just mean, roughly the same size as Earth, when they call you that, knowing you could be a Harvey Dent world, half your face coated in ice, the other covered in syrupy flows of glowing lava. But Earth-like means like Narnia to those who do not know how scientists' brains work, so now millions believe we have found Earth too, a new world just a handful of light years away. Perfectly placed for a weekend getaway. Proxima b, they christened you, unimaginatively, but that cold name, useless for such an important place, will be replaced, I'm sure, with something far more suitable, more fitting for our first star probe's target, screaming by at 1/10 light speed. One impossibly far away day, the first true star sailors will wake from dreamless sleep to weigh anchor off Proxima b. Sweeping in from the great dark, their ship's cobweb-fine solar sails flapping and cracking in the star's gusting wind before finally sliding into orbit around the fabled rocket Prox. And then, lips scalded by centuries-old coffee, their pale faces will press anxiously against snowflake-crusted glass, desperate to see B with their own eyes, and smiling they'll whisper, "We made it."
For as long as our records go back, humans have been looking to the stars. We've used them to navigate, to track weather and tides, and to tell the stories of who we are and where we come from. Here in East Arnhem Land, that connection to the night sky has been passed down for generations. And now it's being carried into the future, propelled by rocket fuel. We're here in Australia, and we're going to launch some rockets. We're following two NASA rocket missions as they try to understand how stars make the planets around them suitable for life. I'm Miles Hatfield, and in this episode, we're talking about living with the stars. The rocket range may be new, but for the people of East Arnhem Land, an interest in the night sky is about as far from new as you can get. This is the traditional home of the Yolnu people, one of the oldest cultures on Earth. As owners of the land and partners in establishing the new Arnhem Space Center, they're enriching cutting-edge space research with thousands of years of tradition connecting them to the night sky. As the NASA crew arrived in Australia, we met Jawa Yunupingu, elder in the Gumach clan, one of the 13 clans comprising the Yolnu Nation. Jawa is also chairman of the Gumach Corporation, which represents the interests of the Gumach people in political and economic affairs. He invited us back to Gumach Corporation headquarters, where we spoke with him and Klaus Helms to learn more about his clan and their long history with the stars.
We talk about the stars and how important they are to the Yolngu people culturally. You know, instead of compasses, we followed the stars to get to wherever we wanted to get to.
One of the stories Jawa told us was about a prominent cluster of stars known to Westerners as the Pleiades. Cultures all over the world have stories about the Pleiades, which are often portrayed as siblings. The Gumach story tells of seven sisters who rowed across the sky in a large canoe. The Gumach refer to them as Julpan, the Yolnu word for canoe.
I think this is kind of the Milky Way, mm-hmm. where the stars are. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the seven sisters, we sing that in our song lines of the Julpan, them. This is the canoe, the Julpan.
According to the story we were told, the seven sisters fish and gather food until they reach their home beyond the horizon, where they cook it. The Yolnu say they can sometimes see the smoke from their fires from beyond the horizon.
In the stories, they look down and, you know, look up at the country as well as the people that they were once, you know.
Learning these stories was a critical part of Jawa's upbringing and a tradition he hopes to uphold for the next generation.
Whether it's from a painting like this, whether it's stories that were handed down from generation, you know, because that's how it happened back in the days. Everything was passed on.
As the traditional landowners, the Gumach Corporation are leasing the land to Equatorial Launch Australia and have been working with them and NASA to make the launch range a reality.
My clan, Gumach, they were well behind this because we were looking at the future kind of a perspective from us, you know, like the stars play a very important role in our survival.
The Gumach board selected Klaus Helms to join them in 2011, and for the past few years, he's been deeply involved in the project.
We had many, many, many meetings with NASA people to see if it was even possible. When Scott first got here, we were walking through the bush of the compass, through all those trees, and he was trying to visualize, could it be done? And, you know, we just had to assure him that, yeah, we can do it, we'll do it. And, you know, the next time he came, it was all cleared. So, you know, that was a sort of like a breather for him to think, oh, yeah. God, yeah. You know, we've got a site.
In a few short days, that site will be put to its first test as it propels a rocket into the night sky for an even clearer view of the stars. But there's one star you can never see at night. I'll give you a hint.
Today, it continues to grow our food, light our way, and keep us warm. That's not food.
That's right, our sun. Next time, how our sun helps us understand habitable worlds elsewhere in the universe, and how it can mislead us.